Hi, I'm Caleb Deschanel, Director of Photography on The Lion King, and you're listening to The Go Creative Show.
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions, and this is The Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today we discuss virtual filmmaking with the cinematographer of The Lion King, Caleb Deschanel. Caleb shares how he used traditional filmmaking techniques in this virtual world, working with photorealistic animals, plus he answers your audience questions and so much more. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, Hedge.video, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and Premium Beat. Well, you guys are going to learn a lot today about virtual filmmaking. We really don't get that many opportunities to have people on that have experienced how to shoot and produce these films. Not many films are created this way. And The Lion King is absolutely stunning. And when you hear how it was filmed, you're going to be amazed. So, and Caleb does a great job of explaining everything from pre-production all the way through. We really get into the nitty-gritty here because, like I said, we don't have many opportunities to dive deep into virtual filmmaking. But that is what today is all about. You'll also notice that we are incorporating audience questions. So you guys have the opportunity to have your question asked on the show. And it's so easy. All you have to do is follow us on social media at Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. And anytime we have an upcoming guest, we're going to post it there so you guys can ask your questions. We'll compile all the questions and ask them on the show. Plus, you get a little shout out with your name too. So what's better than that? Super easy, and it's a great way for you guys to have your voices heard on the show. All right, before we get to our interview, I just want to take a moment and talk about Hedge because they've got big news. They just added a new feature in version 19.3, and this allows filtering and renaming. So real quick, Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers. It's a great way to just import multiple sources, send it to multiple destinations, press transfer, and it goes. But now with filtering and renaming, you have a lot more customization capability. Let me just explain. So filtering allows you to decide which files not to copy. Now, if you guys, if you ever really go into your camera files and you look around, you'll see that there's a lot of files there that you don't necessarily need. And now you can decide if you want them or if you don't. So that's great. But then they also have renaming. And what's great about renaming is that it allows you to add custom data and variables. So it's particularly useful in DSLRs because DSLRs generally don't give you much information at all in the file name. You know, sometimes you mostly get an identifier like EOS and then a counter, but there's no name, there's no date, no reel, nothing. But now with renaming, you're able to do it. So these are both really powerful tools now already in the latest version of Hedge. So head over to hedge.video/GoCreativeShow. That'll give you a 20% off discount on the full license. And it's all over there. You can learn all about filtering, renaming, and all of the great things that Hedge has to offer at hedge.video/GoCreativeShow. All right, let's dive right into it, people. We've got a huge discussion all about virtual filmmaking. So much to learn. And it's all coming up with the director of photography of The Lion King, Caleb Deschanel. So I'm here with Caleb Deschanel, the director of photography for the brand new 2019 version of The Lion King. Caleb, thank you so much for being on.
Sure, glad to be here.
I just saw the film last night, and it really is stunning. I mean, obviously, I'm saying obviously because everybody in the world is a huge Lion King fan, let's be honest. And the challenge of having to recreate such an iconic film is got to be overwhelming. And you guys did it flawlessly. It's different enough that it stands on its own. It's just incredible, the visuals. And I am so excited to talk with you about how you achieved it.
Well, I'm glad to talk about it. I have to say, it was one of the most fun experiences I've ever had doing a movie. It was really eye-opening. And, you know, I was worried when John Favreau first approached me about it, I was worried about it becoming extremely technical and very nerdy, and it was just the opposite. I mean, John basically told me that he was hiring me because of my many years of experience filming live action, and that's what he wanted. I mean, he would go back all the way to the Black Stallion and Fly Away Home. And, you know, he wanted to have, you know, even though everything was created in a computer, he wanted to have the feeling of the movie, you know, as if it was actually filmed live. And that's actually the way we filmed it.
I was honestly, I was stunned. I didn't read anything on The Lion King before I saw it. I really wanted to see it cold. And I have to be honest with you, I truly thought that at least some of the locations were real. They were just too real looking to not have been actual locations. And I was really blown away when I was doing research this morning that everything was virtual. It was just, it was stunning.
Yeah, I mean, that's the remarkable thing. First of all, you have to understand that you know, Rob Legato and, you know, Andy Jones, the animator, and you know, Tom Peitzman and, you know, Jeff Silver and a bunch of us went to Africa. You know, and Audrey, who did all the backgrounds, and Adam Valdez, who, you know, was a visual effects expert. We all went to Kenya and we spent over 2 weeks there traveling around, going to all these different locations. And it really became kind of, you know, a sort of memory Bible for making the movie. And then after we left, MPC sent in a whole bunch of photographers after we had located certain locations that we really liked.
And what is MPC?
MPC is the visual effects company. They're based in London, but they have offices in other parts of the world. And they're the ones who really finished and created the animals, you know, and the locations that feel so realistic.
Yeah.
What they did is that they went and they photographed every piece of grass and rock and tree and leaf and created an incredible library of all that information that then went into creating that reality. And, you know, that's why it feels so real. I mean, I have to say, you know, the course of making this movie was a complete and utter fascinating eye-opener for me, because every time the files would start to come in, you know, we would start with animation that was somewhat limited. I mean, the animals looked fairly realistic and, you know, you could read the emotions and everything and they would move in very realistic ways. But once MPC completed them by putting all the hair, the fur on the animals and, you know, fixing the eyes and having the reflections and everything, you know, every time we saw the files coming back, we were all just amazed at how wonderful it was. I mean, you know, to this day, I'm still amazed at you know, how incredible the process of so many people, so many artists along the way contributed to making this movie, you know, the film that it is.
Talk to me a little bit more about the pre-production. You had mentioned that you went to Africa. You were obviously not shooting plates. You were just going there for inspiration. But what was the process like? Like, were you actually filming things and were you figuring out angles?
We took an Arri 65 camera and that became, you know, basically it was really for, you know, for research. And yet, because we were filming, it sort of also gave us an idea of what we could get away with in terms of reality. I mean, you know, initially, I think John had the idea that we would film it like a real old-fashioned documentary, you know, with very long lenses and everything. But it became really clear that you couldn't really tell the story that way. And, you know, one of the things about going there and filming that we discovered was that we really could get very close to the animals. Or let me put it this way, sometimes the animals would get close to us. I mean, there were times when we were filming, you know, lions that were, you know, lying there on the ground, and then they would get up and they'd walk right by us, you know, within a few feet. And I remember at one point getting upset with my assistant because, you know, the focus was off, and I'm going like, Tommy, he goes, you're inside minimum focus. So that meant the animal was really quite close to us.
Wow.
It was kind of an adventure to find out, you know, what we could get away with. And then, you know, and we also did a lot of research. You know, there are those wonderful BBC documentaries on the planet Earth, and you know, they have some amazing footage of animals and insects and everything that kind of breaks the old barrier of what a documentary can be, and sort of gave us permission too, in a lot of ways, to be able to, you know, to dolly with the animals and move around with them and, you know, sort of be a really intimate part of their lives, which is what was really necessary to tell the story.
Mm. So that's interesting. So you were trying to, you were kind of modeling the cinematography based on what could actually happen had you, like, if you were in the area. So, like, the fact that you got really close to animals in the film, you could do that in real life, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, doing it in virtual reality did not endanger our lives the way, you yes. know, film lions would. I mean, I remember looking up from the camera at one point and our key grip, Kenny, you know, who, you know, is from Kenya and has spent a lot of time around. And, you know, when the lion walked so close to us, I looked up at him and he was sweating. He was really getting worried. So, yeah, I mean, so that was sort of our reference. But then what happened was Rob Legato and a company called Magnopus, which is a visual effects company in Los Angeles, developed all the tools that would allow us to film like it was a real movie. Because what would happen is that the files would be created. And those by files, I mean the scene, the location.
Yeah, and actually, I just want to take a quick step back because I think this is such a unique process. I want to make sure we're walking through it step by step because it's so different than what we usually hear on the show. So I just want to take a quick step back. So you did your research. You went to Africa. You shot everything you need to see. The next step from there, do you immediately go on set and start shooting or do you work with the director for performances? Like how does that work?
Well, it's you know, there are many steps along the way. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, when I first, you know, agreed to do the movie, I went with Rob Legato downtown to Magnopus. And in just a small space, they had a camera, you know, a virtual camera, and they had gears, and they had, you know, enough equipment for me to sort of understand what I was getting into and how much it was going to be like really filming with a real live camera, only in virtual reality. But it was like a real camera. So when I panned and tilt the camera, it moved just like a real camera would in real life.
Wow.
So what we actually, at that time, we actually were able to do a shot which is actually in the movie. So, you know, even early on, we were able to do that. But what happened is we went to Africa, and then James Chinlin, who was the production designer, would then design our locations. He created a whole map, you know, a sort of three-dimensional area of where everything would be, where Pride Rock would be, where the watering hole was, where the elephant graveyard. So there actually was a piece of Africa that was created with relationships between all those different elements. And then that was built in a virtual reality space. And before we did any of the animation with the animals, you know, John Favreau and James and Rob Legato and Andy and Adam and I would all go into virtual reality. So we would have headsets on. And we would sit there and we had controls where we could fly to different places around the location. So we would sit there and I would be maybe, you know, standing on top of Pride Rock looking for some angles and everything. And then John would say to me, oh, Caleb, you've got to look at the watering hole over here. And each of us had, in virtual reality, there was a sort of an image of a helmet, which was different colors. So John's helmet was black, and I would like, if I could click on his helmet, I would instantly be transformed immediately to the watering hole. And then he would say, well, look at this. What do you think of this angle? And I would, you know, go up next to him, and we could move around. And when you moved around, the parallax would change, and everything would change just like it did in real life. And you could find angles, and then you could, you had tools where you could actually take something that looked like an iPad, and you could click a photograph, and then you could leave the iPad there so it would be a reminder for you later that that angle was really good. So there were lots of tools that we would use. And then when we actually got into filming, what would happen is that John would work with, well, first of all, you have to understand we had to record the voices first.
Yeah.
And the thing that John did that was really wonderful, I think, for the movie is that he would bring the actors in who were working together, like, for instance, Pumbaa and Timon, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner, and then the little boy who was playing young Simba, and they would all work together. So there was a real good interplay, just like in a stage play or something, where people have voices could overlap and they could interrupt each other and they could come up with funny lines. And it was really a sort of wonderful process that gave it a life that it wouldn't have had otherwise. And so that was recorded. And then John would work with Andy, the head animator, and his whole team of animators, to sort of work on how do you stage it? What are they doing when they're, for instance, like when, Scar and Simba are walking in the base of the canyon, when, Scar is telling him that he has to, learn how he has to develop his roar. And, like, how are they walking, and where do they go and where do they stop? And does he jump up on a rock or, so we had the sets and, what we do, the first process of the sets was to sort of walk around them and figure them out and then say, well, it's too steep here or there are too many rocks or the cliffs are too tall. I mean, you've virtually had, complete freedom to sort of design it in a way that would really work for you.
Well, what were you basing that criteria on? Like when you're scouting that location virtually, were you like, is your view in the headset, is it the view through the lens or is that like a separate view? You know what I'm saying?
No, the view through the lens would be separate because that means setting up a camera. I mean, it's really like a regular location scout. Wow. Where you are walking around the space. I mean, you didn't have a lot of flexibility for walking around because it was a small area, but you had two controllers that you were holding that had basically laser pointers. And if you pulled on them, they would move you forward or backwards or wherever you aimed the laser. And you could move, to a different location. You could move to the top of Pride Rock. You could move to the platform in front of Pride Rock. You could move to the hills alongside Pride Rock. And you could, basically you do what you do on a location scout where you have a scene that you want to shoot in that location and you start to figure it out and you start to think about how, the characters would move and how they would walk from one place to another or whether they jump up on a rock or whatever they would do in real life, you actually start to imagine and you start to lay out, camera positions. And you also think about the possibility of dollying because once we had the sets and once they started to animate the characters within those sets, then we had something we could work with in terms of figuring out how to stage the camera. In other words, do we want to dolly in towards them? Do we want to dolly along with them as they're talking? What is the coverage we want to get? Do we want it to be done in one shot? And again, we were kind of guided by, reality. I mean, rather than what you would do in an animated film where you could have a camera, a 4mm lens flying around and circling things and spinning around and doing all sorts of fancy things. We wanted to sort of limit ourselves to what we could do in reality. And it's the same thing with the animals. I mean, the animals all behave exactly the way they do in reality, with the exception of the fact that they talk and they sing. Which seems to have bothered some people, but
please everybody.
Not my 7-year-old grandson who thinks it's perfectly okay to have animals talking and singing.
Exactly. All right. So you're recording the performances, the voice performances, and then from there they start animating to the voice performances. Are you involved in the direction of the performance at all?
Well, because it's a whole new process. Yeah. Everything evolved and at first there would be, they would just animate it and then we would get it. And then sometimes we would find we would have problems covering it the way we thought we should cover it. And so then we would go back and either reanimate it, but then the process started to become Andy and, John would have the voice performances and then animate them. And then they would bring Rob and myself in and sometimes the AD, and we would sit and we would talk about it and look at it in terms of where it was in the locations and make suggestions about, well, maybe it'd be better if the lion jumps up on the rock here, and maybe if we got rid of this rock, or maybe if, you know, if they were a little bit separated so that you could get a better, you know, single on him as they walk. So there was a lot of give and take after, you know, a certain point. And so it became, you know, it was a process that developed over a period of a year of filming, you know, that would just constantly be refined.
It seems more collaborative than I thought. Like when I'm imagining the workflow, I was actually kind of assuming that the performances were done and then you guys just had to figure out how best to shoot already existing animated performances.
No, it really, it evolved over time. I mean, sometimes, you know, the animation would come in and we go, well, that's perfect. That's just fine. And other times, you know, because there were certain complications, because, you know, there's certain scenes where you need more coverage, where you need to, you know, cover dialogue, or an action is done in a certain way where you need to be able to see. I mean, you know, it's like everything else. It's like when you do a movie, you know, you're always studying the actors, and sometimes you know, to understand an emotion, you need to be at a certain closeness to an actor to read a subtle emotion in their face. And other times you need to be back farther to read body language or their movements or their, you know, the way they walk about or the way they move. And sometimes, you know, you want to be really back far and see them as a tiny person or a tiny animal in the middle of a vast space and really feel their loneliness or their, you know, so that it was all exactly the same techniques that you use in live action, you know, with, you know, and in this case, the actors were the animals. And, you know, I mean, I think one of the highlights of Andy's time on the movie was I had brought Warren Beatty in to show him what we were up to because he was really curious. And you know, we showed him some of the footage from the movie. And when it was done, he was so impressed with the performance of the animals that, you know, he went to Andy. He says, that's the best performances I've seen in a movie in a really long time. Which, when you consider the fact that you were limited to what an animal could actually do, it's really a real tribute to what the animators were able to do to get, you know, to get emotion out of them and to, you know, and to make that understandable to the audience. You know, and listen, to some extent, you know, it's the juxtapositioning of, you know, images, just, you know, the way, you know, in the old Russian experiments where you take a blank face and you show a baby and then you show the face and it's smiling, and you show some horror and then you show the face and it feels, you know, to some extent, you know, we were taking advantage of that and making the movie, but there are also, you know, there are just thousands and thousands of videos that were studied and, you know, some of the things that we shot where you read into these animals certain expressions and the way they move their faces, even though they may not express what you think, you make that mean what you want by how you juxtapose that to the next shot or the shot that comes before it. So it was just an enormous number of really talented people coming together to sort of create this, you know, this sort of wonderful world.
Let's take a quick moment and talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. But I think the most important thing for you guys to know, the biggest takeaway, is that they have an incredible inventory. They have an inventory. They've been around for over 35 years. So yes, they're going to have a lot of stuff. But when you really dive in and check out their site, they have everything. Everything. Major motion pictures that come through New England use Rule. I mean, so if they're doing it, you should be doing it. And you can simply by going to rule.com. Now, on top of the inventory, they've got amazing service. Production is mission critical. It's super important. Every hour can be thousands of dollars. And Rule's got your back. They're going to give you expert advice and counsel in pre-production and technical guidance when you take the equipment out for your shoot. They are committed to support you and your production. No matter where you are, if you've got Rule equipment on your set, you have support. And that's why we love them. So head over there, rule.com, R-U-L-E, shutterstock.com and check it out. And lastly, shutterstock.com, they've got big news, big news. They just released Elements. Now, Elements are absolutely incredible. What these things are thousands of cinema-grade video effects for filmmakers. So I'm not talking chintzy little crap. These are blockbuster quality video effects. And I don't say that just to like blow smoke. It's the truth. Go and check it out. Go to shutterstock.com, hover over footage, scroll down to Elements and see for yourself. I mean, we're talking about really high-end stuff, and it's created by industry professionals too. So it includes things like lens flares, transitions. You get video kits like smoke, fire, explosions. I mean, what you can do with their effects is absolutely incredible. So head over there, shutterstock.com, hover over footage, go down to Elements, and check out what they have to offer. You will be blown away by what they've done for you guys. And it's all there at shutterstock.com. I want to talk about your camera.
Yes.
Tell me about the camera that you were actually using and also how you were modeling. I think it was an Alexa 65 you were modeling with it. Just kind of tell us about that whole process.
Well, when you go in, you know, when you're in virtual reality and just eliminate virtual and just think of reality, because it was every bit as real for us when we put on the goggles. And you would go in there and then you would watch what was animated. You'd watch the animals and they'd go walking by. And then you say, well, I'd like to have a dolly here. And, you know, I would have a viewfinder where I could adjust the number, you know, the lens. It was actually infinite. It wasn't like you have a 25, 35, 50, 70. It was hard to get an exact lens. So sometimes you'd end up with a 52.3 for some reason.
Yeah, yeah.
See, that matters. But I mean, you try to adjust it to sort of, you know, get it within a range of a wide lens or medium or long lens. So then what you would do, you would say, well, I want a dolly from here. You know, I would sort of move along with them and I'd say, yeah, I'd like a dolly from here to here. And I had one of the tools that I had in virtual reality is that you have a kind of slate that had a picture of a flag. And you would take your controller and you would hold it on the flag and you would click it. And then you had a flag in your hand and you would put the flag and you would release it where you wanted to start the dolly.
Oh my
and then
God.
You'd move over to where the end of the dolly was and you would get another flag and mark there. And then what would happen is that the computer guys would then create a dolly track within virtual reality. And then what they would do is that they would attach the dolly in virtual reality to a real dolly that we had on stage. So we would actually have a real live dolly grip pulling the dolly along with it. So it would have a human feel to it. It wouldn't just be very mechanical that it would just sort of move exactly the way. It would actually have a feeling and you know, you get that feeling. And then the camera, which, you know, you would see, you know, in virtual reality, you would set the camera and it was like modeled after the Alexa 65, but it was just an image of that. And you would set the lens and you'd have it on the dolly and then you would have that hooked up to a gear head, for instance, or it could be a fluid head, depending on what we were doing, but we usually use the gear head. So then we would come out of virtual reality and then on my monitor, I see exactly what the camera in virtual reality is seeing. And then we would start the animals and we would rehearse and the dolly grip would move along and we try it once. I go, you know, it'd be great if you got a little bit ahead of them here. So just speed up a little bit more here and then get around to the front. And then when they stop, you stop here. And, you know, then we would record what we were doing. And, you know, it was pretty amazing.
What were you actually holding? First of all, were you operating or did you have an operator?
Well, I mostly operated, although sometimes, the main thing is we brought a Steadicam operator in, Henry Churl, who's a really wonderful Steadicam operator. We brought him in and, you know, it was a process for him to learn how to operate because, you know, when you're operating a Steadicam, you're usually in the real space, but here he's just walking on a flat surface. And sometimes in the computer, they would tilt the surface. So when he went from one part of the stage to another, he'd actually be going downhill or be going uphill or, you know, stepping over rocks or whatever. So that became, you know, part of the, you know, of the process. You know, at first it was mostly done with, you know, regular cameras on dollies or with a long lens, just static, maybe as if it was on a tripod or whatever. But then we became more adventuresome, and there was a system called OptiTrax, and OptiTrax is a series of cameras that were all around the ceiling of the stage. And what they would do is that they could read a controller, which was basically a series of LED lights. I think there's something like 8 LED lights that would then be a camera. And you could then hand-hold the camera in OptiTrax. And when you would tilt it, it would tilt the camera. And when you dropped it down, it would go lower. And if you moved to the right or left, it would move. So anywhere within the OptiTrax space in the stage, you could move this controller, and it would be as if you were moving a camera.
Wow.
So, you know, that was the first thing we did. And we did some handheld stuff inside the caves with the when the cubs are being chased by the hyenas. And, you know, since it was all new, it became, you know, how do you do this? Because the, you know,
I love that.
The tunnels were very complex. So you'd have to draw with tape on the ground exactly where you were moving so that you would go left and then right and then up and then down. And, you know, we would even build platforms on the stage so that if we could go up a little higher and a little bit farther down. And it was a year of invention. I mean, it was like being back in film school and saying, all right, here's a brand new tool. How do we use it? You know, and how can we help tell this story with these tools, you know, in a better way? I mean, for instance, you know, when we had the Steadicam, the space was about a 25-foot square space that OptiTrax could control. And yet, you know, because we were not filming like you... In animation, generally, you film just little shots. You say, okay, we need this shot, we need this shot. But because we had, you know, entire scenes, you know, in a file, for instance, when, you know, Pumbaa and Timon are singing Whim Away, and they're coming down a hill and everything, we were able to cover that whole thing in one long shot. And we covered it with a Steadicam, but we found because we were limited by the 25-foot square feet, we were actually having to travel 130 feet in virtual reality. We made this discovery that we could actually hook the entire floor that the Steadicam is on to the dolly and then move it 150 feet. And then within that 150 feet, Henry could, you know, walk around the animals and move closer and move farther back. But then you had the added complication of the dolly is moving at a certain speed and the Steadicam can move at a certain speed. So then you had to rehearse between the dolly grip and Henry, who was going to do what, who was going to move faster and farther and right, and it became this sort of amazing choreography and dance between the dolly grip and Henry, you know, and working out these shots. And it became, you were able to do things that were both, you know, acceptable in terms of the realism of movie making, and yet at the same time, if you really thought it through, you'd realize how extraordinary they were, you know.
Now, I know your camera was modeled, I guess we've been saying. Yeah. But did they model like the attributes of the camera or the lenses? Like, were you modeling lenses to get specific elements of a lens package?
Yeah, well, we ended up, you know, wanting to, you know, because listen, lenses are never perfect. And the lenses that we had were basically perfect lenses. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So what you wanted to do was sort of build into them the sort of aberrations that you know that you would get you know, in a real lens. So, you know, that became a really important aspect of it too. And we actually, Dan Sasaki, who designs lenses for Panavision, is really a genius about it. And he actually designed the lens that we used, the zoom lens we used in Africa, so that we would be able to, you know, film the kind of things we did. And he came in and you know, spoke to, you know, all the people involved about, you know, all the different aberrations that you get from different lenses and what they look like. And it's really amazing, because if you see a perfect lens and you see something photographed with a perfect lens, it you know, it feels kind of unreal, you know, whereas lenses all have sort of slight, you know, astigmatisms and all sorts of things in them and that we become used to. I mean, like, if you look at an anamorphic lens, there tends to be, you know, very sort of, you know, soft at the top and bottom. And then, you know, there's certain amounts of distortion, you know, that you know, sometimes it's called mumping, where it'll make a face look bigger. And so you would sometimes use different lenses for different distances because of, you know, how the anamorphic is altering the lens and everything. And we didn't shoot anamorphic, but we really wanted to have an understanding of that so that we would, you know, really, it would inform us while we were filming. So listen, the whole process was a huge learning curve and was a huge, you know, just, it was like being in a sandbox all the time, playing around with different toys and trying them and seeing how you could use them in different ways to help tell the story.
It just seems like so much fun. It just, like, what an adventure.
It was an adventure. And something I haven't talked about yet, Sam Maniscalco was the lighting guy, and we were operating within a game engine called Unity. And, you know, we could, you know, I mean, listen, most of the film is outdoors in the sun. Yeah. And we could move the sun around. And what would happen is that after the animation was finished and we had the location and the animation finished, before we go to stage, I would sit with Sam and we would go through something like 350 different skies that were in our library, you know, and we would pick skies that we felt were appropriate for the time of day, the emotions of the scene, whatever happens to be going on. And we would pick a sky, and then we would, you know, we would set the sun and where the sun would be. And when we were on stage, Sam was there all the time. And every time we would do a shot, we would set the sun. And then, you know, we would do another shot. And almost with every shot, I would alter where the sun was. And it's one of those paradoxes where you would think that, you know, the fact that you could keep the sun in the same place, so that if you're doing a scene that takes place at exactly the same time, you keep the sun where it is. Well, it's not really true, because if you think about it, when you film a real movie and you have a scene that maybe is 3 or 4 pages long and it takes you all day to do it, the sun comes up in the east and it moves across the sky and, you know, and then moves to the west and sets, and you have to shoot in a way that makes sure that you can cut all that together. Well, the big shock was that while we were filming this movie that we could virtually keep the sun in the same place all the time, it actually turned out to be much better to just kind of accept the real filmmaking process, that the sun moves across the sky and you figure out ways of cutting it together. And it also made it possible to, you know, to make the lighting more pleasing or more appropriate for the scene in some way or other too. So we would move the sun just almost all the time. It was really pretty amazing.
Every filmmaker would kill to be able to just stop the motion of the sun so they could get their scenes done, not race daylight. And you guys are purposely adding that problem into your workflow. I think that is just so incredible.
Well, you know, you think that's true.
I love the philosophy about it too, though.
You know, and yet at the same time, you suddenly realize that, you know, the world is sort of giving you a gift by changing all the time. I mean, listen, there are times on the set, you know, where the clouds are rolling in and you're just tearing your hair out because, you know, you started the scene in the sun and you don't want it to go into overcast, and You know, there are those moments, but there are also those incredible moments where you design your day so that you shoot, you know, one direction in the morning and another direction at noon and, you know, in a different place. And, you know, it's why when you do a movie, you know, you're always sort of begging the AD or the production manager to schedule shooting at one location in the morning and at another location in the afternoon, because you know that the light's going to be better and you know that it's going to help you instead of hurt you. And, you know, occasionally you get, you know, you aren't able to do that and it becomes really frustrating, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it was, we kind of created our own reality that we could alter, but at the same time, we were kind of taking the guidelines that we've always used over the years to make films.
Did you use any other additional lighting? Like, were you, obviously the sun is there, you can move it wherever you want, but were you also putting in like virtual bounces and eye lights and things like that?
Well, you have to understand that in, you know, in Unity, to some extent, there is a program which accepts the fact that you have, you know, if you just have the sun, it just, you know, and there was no sky, it would just be, you know, a very harsh light with black shadows. But, you know, if you think about it, when you're outside and you're in the shade, you know, if you're not in the sunlight, you're being lit by the sky, and the sky is blue. So, you know, over the years, I always would use blue cloth for bouncing light rather than white, because you know, white just bounces daylight, which is 5,600 degrees Kelvin, but skylight is 10,000 or 20,000 degrees Kelvin, depending on how blue it is. And if you're ever in New York City or some big city and you're in, you know, one of these canyons between these big buildings and there's no sunlight, you'll notice suddenly it'll get very bright and you'll look up above and there's a cloud that comes over and then the cloud disappears and it gets dark again. I mean, you know, so we're constantly realizing all these things and, you know, there is the sunlight that lights. And then we did have skylight that was, you know, basically the fill. So, and then also, I mean, in the final film, you know, there's a program called RenderMan, which is developed by Pixar, which actually takes into consideration everything in the scene and how the light bounces off that and bounces back into the lion. And so if the ground is reddish, then there's reddish light that bounces up from the ground. And if there's a white rock next to them, then the white rock. And if there are two lions walking next to each other, well, then the sunlight bounces off the fur of one lion and creates a sort of warm light bouncing into the shadow part of the other lion. And, you know, there are just so many things. And there's so much, you know, there's a lot of science that goes into it, too. I mean, if you look at this first scene of when Mufasa takes Simba up to the top of Pride Rock and the wind is blowing, it's an incredibly complex computer program that figures out what the wind, you know, what the effect of the wind is on the mane of the lion.
Yeah.
You know, or the grass being blown. And, you know, I mean, it's amazing. And there's a lot of physics that goes into the art of this movie, but, you know, it's all to serve the storytelling. And that's really ultimately no different than making any other movie.
So am I understanding it right? You were not adding additional lights. You just, the sun was it, and it was, they were basing it off the reflections of how it would be in real life?
I would say that's generally true, but there were times when, for instance, the sky wasn't producing as much fill as you would normally expect, so you'd have to, you know, do that. And there are actually a couple of scenes in the movie in the canyon where, don't tell anybody, but I actually used two suns. And
how dare you?
Yeah. Well, you can't tell, but you know.
just because you needed extra light?
The way the design of the canyon was such. And the other thing too, that, you know, another aspect of what we were doing is when we were in the canyon, we'd find sometimes you would have the sun, you know, in a certain place and you kind of want to have a little bit more light hitting something. And you could actually move rocks down or move them out of the way. And you know, that was a lot of the lighting we did. And then also when you know, they go up into the cloud forest, which is the area where when Simba follows Timon and Pumbaa up, you know, into the cloud forest area. You know, there were really thick forests, and, you know, because the light reacts, you know, to anything that creates shadow, we then ended up by the way we would light it was we would set the sun where we wanted it, but then we had to start pulling trees out to get, you know, the dappled light that we were looking for.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that in the final film did not totally match, you know, what we wanted to do, because, you know, our trees were not as sophisticated and as perfect as the trees they would do. So they were, you know, so when it was finished and they had the real acacia trees or whatever they happened to be, it would cast different shadows than we created. So there were some, you know, some variations there that, you know, for the most part, though, I mean, I was relatively happy. But you know, there's just so many processes along the way that sort of alter what you know, your intentions are sometimes in the beginning.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. It's called War on Goods by Midway Music. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. Head over to PremiumBeat.com to get access to a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. $49! And I'm not just talking about the individual track, because you get loop sets, you get cutdowns, you get stems. So what this means is with all those little pieces, you can customize the track to fit your project perfectly. But it's all about quality, let's be honest, and that's what you're going to find at PremiumBeat.com. I am not lying when I tell you, PremiumBeat is the first stop when I'm looking for stock music. The first stop, and most of the time, I don't have to go anywhere else, because I have exactly what I need. I share it with the client in a little library. They love the tracks and it all works smoothly and efficiently. So head over to premiumbeat.com and check it out for yourself, premiumbeat.com. And lastly, I wanna talk about MagRents, Magnanimous Rentals. Here's the thing, I go to three video like related websites every day. Without a doubt, every single day I go to these three sites. One, newsshooter.com, because they always have the latest and greatest news. Two, B&H, because I want to see what they've got in their deal zone. But three, it's Magnanimous Rentals. Yes, Magnanimous Rentals. Well, why? Well, first of all, Magnanimous Rentals is a production equipment rental house. They're located in Chicago, but they ship all over the country. So what I'm about to say, anybody within the United States is able to take advantage of. They are, first of all, they got a great inventory, but they are obsessed with prices. They have the best prices in the business. You cannot beat their price. It's impossible. It's impossible. And that's just their regular prices. But then on top of that, they have these things called flash discounts. And these change all the time. And that's why I go to the site every day, because I want to know what's on flash discount. I want to know. And these are steeply, steeply discounted items, but it's only for a limited time. So that's where you need to check it all the time. Flash discounts are insane. I got an Alexa Mini for like 3 or 4 days for under $1,000. It was craziness, absolute craziness. And there's deals all the time. So head over to magrents.com. Check out their inventory, certainly, but also look for those flash discounts. You'll know it's a flash discount because it's in bright red and it says flash discount. And if you click on it and go through the process, you will see how inexpensive that flash discount is. It's sometimes up to 50% off. So this is no joke, people. And the best part is, as long as you place your order while the flash discount is going on, it's fine. It doesn't matter when your shoot is. It just matters when you place the order. So perfect for anybody, no matter when your shoot is. So head over there, magrents.com. All right. Thanks for sticking with me, guys. We've got so much more interview to go, so much more to learn with Caleb Deschanel from The Lion King. Can you talk to us about the post-production process? I mean, was there a traditional color grade process or anything that you were involved in after shooting?
Yeah, I mean, the The one big difference is that when you shoot a scene, like I was saying, we shot scenes, you know, as complete scenes sometimes with a long dolly track following, you know, the animals singing for, you know, a minute or whatever the length of the song is. But when they cut it together, they would use a piece of that dolly and then they would cut to another shot and then maybe use another piece of the same dolly. In other words, they might use three sections of that piece of dolly.
Yeah.
You know? But now they're considered to be separate shots. So one animator might take one and another animator in another part of the world take another. So you get variations both in terms of, you know, contrast and sometimes lighting and things, even though it's essentially the same. I mean, the sun's coming from the same place and everything, but there would be just slight variations. So, you know, when it came to time for the movie, you know, if I was doing a, you know, a movie and you use a live action shot, each, you know, if I shot it for real, each one of those shots would be taken from a long dolly shot and you would time each one of those exactly the same. But because a different person was completing them when they were separated into separate pieces after the editing, they were considered separate shots. So there would be slight variations. So it, you know, it meant that Steve Scott, who was the color timer, had to time each one of those slightly differently. It wasn't huge. I mean, it'd be on the order of, you know, slight contrast difference or a slight color variation or whatever, but it was enough that it made his work a little more difficult than it would have been on a regular live action movie.
What was the schedule like for this? Because that, like now that you're talking about it, you brought something up that I wasn't even thinking about, is that the performance are flawless every time. Like that's, you don't need to retake for performance. So
I mean, you know, oddly enough, you know, the thing that was really great about it was, especially when you had, you know, 500 wildebeest running through a canyon, is that you could bring them back to one and at the press of a button, as opposed to waiting, you know, 45 minutes for the wranglers to gather them together and get them back. But what was missing, though, was, you know, when you film live, there's a certain serendipity of things being different. An actor does something different, or, you know, the clouds come in and it starts to rain or something. And sometimes that's wonderful. And that's the thing you miss. But the one way we took advantage of there being no serendipity was the fact that we had the freedom to try a lot of different things that you wouldn't try. I mean, for instance, if you were filming the wildebeest in a canyon, you would set up, you know, maybe 8 cameras, but they would all be very high percentage choices for where you put the cameras. But because we could repeat it a number of times, we would have those high, you know, those high percentage shots, but then we could also go with, you know, really sort of crazy shots that sometimes would give you would be revealing about what's happening with the characters in a way that you would never get if you actually were filming it live. So there was that. But it was a long process, partly because it took a while for the animation. I mean, you know, it wasn't like the files would be in and be ready to shoot. Is, you know, and they were constantly upgrading all the tools and all the systems, you know, in the computer. So there were many days where I would sit and be lighting with Sam, you know, on files that were finished while they were trying to upgrade, you know, the software and the computers on the stage. And so it was it was a longer process than you might think, just because of, you know, the fact that everything was new and, you know, sometimes there'd be bugs in things that would have to be worked out. And then, you know, the code would have to be rewritten and all that sort of thing.
One thing I read is that you used an actual drone for the Circle of Life sequence.
I mean, originally, you know, Rob had this idea of going outside and figuring out some way of encoding the drone so we could film over a long distance. Because, you know, the big worry is that for the drone to work on the stage, it had to operate within this 25-foot square OptiTrax area. And were worried that the drone, that because you were multiplying the distance the drone was traveling by hundreds. In other words, the drone was flying 25 feet and you were saying that it's, you know, flying an eighth of a mile. So that was a big worry, but it turned out that the stabilization on the drones was so extraordinary that we were able to do drone shots, you know, within that space and still multiply the distances traveled by hundreds and hundreds of times. So it was really fun because we ended up, you know, it was laid out so that we would have C-stands set up at different heights that would be the height of trees and things that the drone had to fly over, or would be references and you know, for the height of Pride Rock and everything. And then, you know, we would work that out with them and then we would fly it. And, you know, the drone operator would just have to fly it. And then we had the camera hooked up to our gear head so that as he flew, I could pan and tilt the camera around to get the shots that we wanted to get. So it was really, I mean, I was really kind of shocked that that worked, but Rob is very adventurous when it comes to visual effects, and, you know, he had confidence it was going to work, and, you know, we kind of brought them in as a test day and then ended up getting a lot of shots that ended up in the movie.
It helps, I think, because it makes it more realistic. Like I said, I mean, I really was blown away that I thought for sure something must have been real. Because it just looks so realistic, those environments. My God. Monitoring. Were you guys looking through headsets or just traditional monitors?
No, we had mainly it was monitors. I mean, you could actually stand behind the camera in virtual reality and watch it. I mean, but in general, it was mostly like it was like doing a film where, you know, the whole time you're on a remote head. Mm. Because what the camera saw, you would see on a monitor, and then, you know, you would pan and tilt. But it was always important when you first got the scenes that you were going to do, it was really important to really study it in virtual reality. Because if you were to just set up a shot just by zooming in or moving the camera around, you would often find you wouldn't understand the physicality of where you were in the space if you were just lining it up through the camera. So yeah. It's really important to be in virtual reality to understand, like, oh, yeah, I get it. Oh, I'm up by this rock here, and I need to have the dolly go uphill. And we need, you know, it just gave you a real understanding of what you needed to do. And, you know, and the same physics, you know, of like how, where you put the chassis for the, you know, or the, you know, the support for the crane, where you put it so that when it swings around or goes up and down, it had exactly the same physics. So you had to understand the way you would if you were on a real location, where to put the chassis for the crane, you know, so that you could get the shot you wanted to get. So all that experience, you know, over the years was really valuable for what we were doing, because, you know, the same physics, you know, existed, you know, the same inertia and physics and everything else. So it was pretty, pretty amazing.
In our last couple of minutes, we just have some audience questions. You know, most of these have already been answered. I feel bad. Rosemary Clark is asking how much of the time were you shooting real live animals? None of the time, Rosemary, but I guess that's a testament to the great work that you did, that was even a question. Nick Andrews, he's got a question here. Was the first movie, so I'm guessing he's talking about the animated movie, was that used for visual inspiration and storyboarding? And if so, how much? And did it impact your cinematography?
You know, I mean, we studied the film and, you know, it's a really wonderful film, but, you know, once we started filming, we kind of threw everything away and just started filming in the way that we thought would best tell the story. Yeah. You know, there are people who claim that it's, you know, it's just shot for shot. You know, it's somebody who hasn't seen the movie in a long time who would say that. Because, you know, it really is very different. It really, it's it's understanding it in a reality that's very different than the animated film. And, you know, listen, I have no problem with people loving the first film, and if they want to love it more, it's fine. But they're, you know, it's sort of like saying, you know, you've seen Hamlet once, you don't need to see it again, you know, even though Nicole Williamson or somebody is playing Hamlet, you know, it's different, and, you know, in its own way, it's I think really special. And, you know, it's just remarkable that, you know, John was able to sort of bring together all these great artists and, you know, get the best out of them and create this movie, you know?
It didn't feel shot for shot to me. I think maybe that misconception is just because I think the teaser trailer was shot for shot but I thought that was on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, the Circle of Life is very close to what was done in the original. So, I mean, that's true. So maybe they just watched the first part of the movie and didn't see the rest of it. I don't know.
Another question Wes Anthony is asking. Well, actually, we kind of answered this, too. How did you shoot a CGI movie? What tools did you bring over from principal photography? We talked about it, Wes, but thanks for the question. It's a great one, but we already did tackle it. So Nick Rosemary and Wes, thank you guys so much for asking your questions. And all you listeners here, when we have upcoming guests, we post it on our social media so you can get your questions heard on the show as well. Well, Caleb, the movie was stunningly beautiful. Like, I am blown away that nothing of it was real. I actually feel kind of stupid because I was duped. I was duped. I really thought something was real in that film. But it was so enjoyable to watch. I absolutely loved it. The work that you did was innovative, and I think cinema is changing. I mean, I know Avatar's coming out, and I've heard that a lot of the work that you guys are doing and the way you shot Lion King is also being employed in that. I'd love to hear from you, just where do you think the future of cinematography is going now that you've gone through this process?
Well, I think there's no question that there's a melding of visual effects and cinematography, you know, that's sort of inevitable. I mean, even the most conventional movies that I've done in the last 10 or 15 years have an enormous number of visual effects. Not that you would ever know that they were visual effects. I mean, it's not like going to see, you know, Avengers where you know it's visual effects.
But, yeah.
You know, movies with, you know, actors doing things where, you know, backgrounds have been changed or, you know, faces cleaned up or, you know, something that ended up in frame shouldn't be there. I mean, it's just a tool that's so available now because, you know, it's gotten faster and cheaper and, you know, it's just a part of everyday life. I mean, to the point where, you know, you start to accept that. So I think I think the main thing is to have a really great team. I mean, I was just really honored to work with Rob Legato and, you know, all the visual effects people. But I mean, we just became a sort of wonderful team bouncing ideas off of each other and filming in a very conventional way, but still, you know, in a way that would not be possible in the real world. So, I think what it probably opens up is the potential for, limiting the amount of travel that you need to do a film, or, you know, being able to control things in terms of, you know, your imagination. I mean, listen, every tool that comes about, in the end, you know, how good is the tool? It's only as good as the artists who are the ones who take command of it. And that's the reality. It will always be the reality, from the first filmmakers, from Melies to, you know, D.W. Griffith to John Ford to Alfred Hitchcock. It's like, you know, how are you using those tools to tell the story? Because, you know, in the end, you know, You can make a short film that's just a bunch of visual images, but in the end, to tell a story over a period of time of an hour or 2 hours, you need to have something that's compelling to us as human beings.
A great story is everything, and what a great note to end on. Caleb, thank you so much for being on the show. We didn't get to talk about the rest of your career, and there is so much there. I mean, my God, you have such an amazing portfolio here, and we're going to have you on for your next film and focus on some of the other work that you've done. But there's just so much here to talk about with virtual filmmaking. And thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us.
You're welcome. It was fun.
So where can people go to learn more about you? Do you have an Instagram, Twitter, website? Where should people go?
you know, believe it or not, despite doing the most advanced technological filmmaking, I don't have any of that stuff. But there is a wonderful book that is coming out about the making of The Lion King. So, you know, it's probably a good place to refer to it. And also, American Cinematographer this month has a whole, section devoted to the making of Lion King with interviews between, you know, with me and Rob Legato about, you know, exactly the kinds of things we've been talking about. So that's another good place to look for additional information.
Yeah, we're going to link a whole bunch of stuff in our show notes. So you guys, if you head over to Go Creative Show and click on this post, we'll put some behind the scenes videos on there. We'll do his American Cinematographer interview. We'll have a lot there all in one place so you guys can really enjoy. Caleb Deschanel, thank you so much for being on. We really appreciate it and already looking forward to your return.
All right. Thanks so much.
There he goes, Caleb Deschanel. Thank you so much for sharing your insights about virtual filmmaking. My God, it sounds crazy. It sounds scary and exciting at the same time, doesn't it? I want to try it. I want to see this thing being done. I also want to thank Matt Russell and Connor Crosby. Connor Crosby is our producer. You can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. And Matt Russell mixes and masters and makes the show sound so delicious. And he can do the same for your projects. That's the best part about it. You can find him at gainstructure.com, gainstructure, and on Twitter at gainstructure. And of course, while you're there, tweet us at Go Creative Show. In fact, go to all of our social media locations, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can check out what's going on with the show and get an opportunity to have your questions asked. Of course, I want to thank our sponsors, Hedge.video, Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, and Premium Beat. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist, so please support those that support us. We'll see you next week.